Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 3 issues for just £5. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today. Hello and welcome back to Black's History Week. Why did the detective novel become popular in the Victorian era and experience a golden age in interwar Britain? How far has the genre evolved since then? And can historians learn much about the preoccupations of their period by reading this form of literature? In this podcast, Professor Jeremy Black talks to The Critic's political editor, Graham Stewart, and sifts through the evidence.
Professor Jeremy Black, you're well known as a historian of very wide range, but perhaps many will be unaware of the fact that you're also a great lover of detective novels. Tell me, do you enjoy detective novels as an escape from history or as a way of using your own historian's detective skills in a slightly different format?
Oh, the former rather than the latter. I mean, I enjoy a story and I don't spend my time trying to outthink the author and trying to, as it were, trying to work out the solution before they anticipate you doing that or anything like that. No. I've also actually, since we're talking on The Critic's website, I've actually published a number of articles through your internet site on detective novels and on some of the recent ones. And I hope listeners find our discussion interesting, but they might also then like to read some of those pieces.
Well, we're going to come in due course to the British Library's Crime Classics collection, which have been published. But I thought we'd just take a step back, not too many steps back. I don't want to go all the way back into the ancient classical riddles or the Arabian Nights or Chinese chalk circles or anything. But I want to go into when we might see really the birth of the modern detective novel. I'm struck by the fact that the genre doesn't really exist until certainly the end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that's very interesting. I mean, again, I agree with you. We don't want to look at detection in all aspects of earlier literature. I do think the actual puzzle, the actual possibility that evil is masquerading as good, are elements you can see a long way back in English vernacular literature. You can see it, for example, in drama. You can think of John Webster's plays. Or even for that matter, William Shakespeare's Hamlet, you can see it in, I think, a very important source because it links to the morality you subsequently see in writers like Agatha Christie, which is the kind of religious itinerary. I mean, the most famous example of that is John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, in which there are evil people masquerading as good in order to waylay the individual. And in a sense, there is a profoundly religious underpinning to a lot of the classic ideas about detection, and detection is, after all, detecting the role of evil, because classical religion, Augustinian religion, has evil as a real presence. I mean, you know, obviously modern Christianity is a heresy compared to the profundities of Augustinian thought, and in Augustinian thought you have classically these two cities, the city of God, the city of the devil, and the agents of the city of the devil are trying to attack those of the city of God. Now, if we then take that forward into the 19th century, you can come along with an economic, sociological account. You can talk about the necessity in a society which is urbanizing, which is socially volatile, where people are uncertain of identity, where policing is being brought forward as an attempt to control this society. You can, in other words, present it in a sort of classic Marxist account. I would actually just, since I think that, you know, historians are apt to be a bit silly in these respects, I would actually draw attention rather to things like the increase in commuting, the increase in train journeys, the entrepreneurs like W.H. Smith producing station booksellers, and the need by people for are going to work for their leisure. And much about the Victorian enormous growth in fiction, and the detective novel is just an aspect of that, reflects demand. You know, that demand, you shouldn't think necessarily that somebody only reads detective fiction. Somebody in 1880, 1890 might be switching between genres. And therefore, the detective novel is an aspect of people's, you know, forget about all this stuff about search for identity. Let's just say novels you enjoy reading.
I'm wondering if there is a connection between the growth of popular newspapers reporting crime and court proceedings being published, whether this feeds the creation of detective novels, or actually whether the detective novel develops semi-independently from the novel.
No, I think that's very true. I mean, as you may know, I did a number of books on newspaper history, and in all three of them, I talk a lot about the reporting of crime, which is very big in the 18th century and gets even bigger in the 19th century with newspapers like the News of the World. And of course, you have famous criminals and criminal episodes, the murder of William Weir, for example, which I've written about. In which the press goes absolutely mad and writes about at great length. And obviously later in the century, you've got, the Ratcliffe Highway, and eventually you've got Jack the Ripper, of course. And so the press, and of course one of the key things about the press is that it runs several editions a day in places like London. So you're actually keeping up with stories as they develop, it's something that readers clearly were interested in, and it was certainly a staple of the Sunday newspapers, which were the largest circulation newspapers for most of the century. So I think it's fair to say, yes, you're absolutely right, that crime reported as this is what has happened is very much a staple of press, and then that overlaps with journals such as the Strand magazine, for example, in which you are presenting the stories of writers who are offering you their putative detective, so that there is a flow. And I mean, we tend to think of detective novels. I think it might be more appropriate to think of detective stories and to think of short stories as being absolutely crucial in linking the world of the press with the world of the more formed novel.
Well, how about the great novelists, though? I mean, Charles Dickens, Bleak House says that the Lord Tolkington being murdered, and then there's a bit of a whodunit. In America, you've got Edgar Allan Poe, and then you have Wilkie Collins, the Woman in White.
And of course, Dickens' last novel, I mean, we don't know how exactly it would have gone, but that's a detective novel, or what survives of it is a detective novel. And Wilkie Collins, absolutely. I mean, Wilkie Collins, brilliant with his, as it were, multi-perspective, which is multiple perspectives on the same event, which, of course, helps to make The Moonstone such a brilliant success. I think you're absolutely right. The great novelists are writing stories in which there is a puzzle. Now, of course, you can go back to that and go back in that. I mean, you know, for example, you can actually have comic novels which have a puzzle. I mean, where Tom Jones comes from in Henry Fielding's novel of that name is an example of that. But the point about the novels you're talking about is that there is an element that is generally more sinister. I mean, I think it's fair to say that The Moonstone is not as sinister as The Woman in White, but there is a more sinister element, and an element, I mean, you mentioned Bleak House, there can be an element of society itself as being potentially pernicious, or there can be an element in which there is, as in The Woman in White, a conspiracy. Or they can be just individual fault or flaw. And all of those look towards themes and theses of the 20th century detective novel.
Well, we come invariably to Arthur Conan Doyle and to Sherlock Holmes. But I want to ask a question relating not just to Holmes, but to all the way through to Agatha Christie's Miss Marple and beyond. And this is the idea of the private detective, either a citizen in her own right or someone like Sherlock Holmes who is doing it for a profession, but who isn't a police inspector. What do you see as the kind of cultural roots of that approach?
Well, I think it's part, I mean, it's multiple. I mean, of course, you get exactly the same thing in adventure fiction. Somebody like Richard Hannay in 39 Steps, he is not actually a member of the intelligence services. So I think there's a whole host of things, but it's in part an idea that an individual of ability can actually use their skill, their ability to interact in society, to open doors, whether intellectually or socially, that the police do not do. And of course, it's also in part the conceit that you do not need the formal technical services of the the forensic laboratories and all the rest of it. Although, as we know, a number of the detectives, Sherlock Holmes is a classic example, actually are in effect private scientists as well. I mean, but most of them are not, and they mostly use, and in fact Agatha Christie has Poirot in effect criticizing the Holmes approach by saying that he can solve a murder without actually going to the scene of it. And that represents a very different approach to the police procedural. And I think it's fair to say that the police procedural has always been a traditional theme of writing, but it isn't the central theme in the classic detective novel.
So it's not an attempt just to kind of upend order in which the professionals are always seen to be plodding around, excuse the pun, whilst the clever individual is actually the person who solves it.
No, I wouldn't say that. And I think it's very much an aspect of writing about character in the late 19th and early 20th century, which reflects their desire to think that the private individual is as important or more important than the state.
The interwar years are often described as the golden age of detective novels, and a period of particularly women novelists, Dorothy L. Sayers, Agatha Christie, Josephine Tay, and so on. Is coming at this from the perspective of a historian, is there any explicable reason for why there should have been such a rich harvest of detective novels between the two wars, in Britain at least?
Yes, I mean, that's a very good question. I think that you've got, obviously, universal education. You've got very high rates of literacy. You've got although there are obviously new media, most clearly radio. I think it's fair to say that book reading, and in fact, book includes short stories here, dominates personal leisure. You have disposable income, particularly in the 20s, but also in the 30s. Remember, in southern England, and indeed much of England, the Great Depression is not one which actually hits the living standards of large chunks of the population, which indeed is why the national government does so well in its two general elections. And you also have entrepreneurial publishers, and the combination of all of those factors encourages, I think, a publication of a large number of titles. That's, I think, the key point. Not all of these titles are successful, and sometimes one comes across authors that one's not familiar with. But what is really interesting is how many titles are coming through, and that, in a sense, then helps both publisher and reader, and indeed reviewer, to play a role in helping to frame the market.
And the idea of a crime or thriller book club, when does that date from?
Well, yes. I mean, you've got, as you know, a whole host of devices in the 1930s in order to try and organise reading practices. You've got lending libraries, for example, from places like Boots and Woolworths, and you would borrow particular types of books there. And in a sense, just as incidentally, as I point out in one of my press books, you've also got lots of schemes used to encourage people to read particular newspaper titles. It's all part of trying to frame, I don't mean that in a negative sense, but frame the market. And I think that's quite important, because if you can guarantee a relatively reasonable sales figure, then, or borrowing figure from people that are paying to borrow, then what you can then do is produce a reasonable print run at a modest cost, which then in turn generates more readers. And I think it's fair to say that well-known detective novelists were, you know, safe bets sounds pejorative, but that is important commercially. They were safe bets. And then can I make a broader point? I published a book on some years ago on 20th century Britain, in which I made the point that the interwar years were really important for what I termed middle brow writers. That, you know, all too often people talked about somebody like, I don't know, Virginia Woolf. But Virginia Woolf was not, and the modernists were not the typical writers of the 20s and 30s. The typical writers of the 20s and 30s, and the writers whose books went on selling, even if these people were older, were people like Arnold Bennett, John Galsworthy, people who had a sense of social order, social structure, often, as with Winifred Holtby, a very granulated sense of place, in her case, Yorkshire. And then, therefore, what then happens is the detective story is not, as it were, separate to that. It's part of the same process in the 20s and 30s, because the detective story usually carries with it a very granulated sense of place. You know, where is it set? Is it set in, as it were, a genteel village? Is it set in a more rundown area, etc., etc.? So you've got a granulated set of place, and you've also got the nuances of social relationships and how those are put under strain and why they are put under strain. So in many respects, the detective novel is an aspect of the more general fiction of that period.
Well, you talk a moment ago about a sense of place, and not only are many of the novelists of this period British, the plots are set in a very British, usually very English landscape. At the centre of which, of course, is the classic country house murder. I mean, if in 1920s and 1930s, this is a period when the country house is in decline, rapid economic decline, many are being demolished. Is it a nostalgic sense for country house living, or just an idea of encouraging readers to take a look at a richer lifestyle than they can afford themselves?
Well, that's very interesting. I mean, first of all, it's much more diverse, the writing. I mean, I recently commented in The Critic on Josephine Bell's The Port of London Murder, which is very much set in a rather grubby London Docklands. So there are novels that are different. But as far as a country house is concerned, a country house is like a sleeper train. It's like an Oxbridge college. It's like a girls' or boys' boarding school. It has a finite number of entrances. It has a finite number of people there. It is, in a sense, a simulacrum of a small village. So that, yes, there can be aspects of snobbery and all the rest of it, you know, who killed Dr. Stewart in the library, that kind of thing. But the reality is that there are actually devices that you need in order to limit the number of potential culprits. And a country house provides that.
We're still very familiar with the country house detective plot from the TV and film adaptations that have been made in recent years. But did these plots in the novels really stop at the time of the Second World War and have become not such an important force thereafter?
Well, it's very interesting. First of all, on the country house, and it's worth bearing in mind that the Moonstone, which goes right back to the 19th century, is in effect a country house story. After World War II, you do get some of the classic accounts, but they appear dated. It's rather like, I mean, Woodhouse is still bumping out Jeeves novels, but they don't appear to work terribly well. And of course, it's worth bearing in mind that when Christie goes back to Stiles, she presents a very different social location to when she'd set her story there a half century earlier. I think it's fair to say that some of the settings after the war are similar in the sense that you can still have your country village, for example. You can still have your secluded environment. I mean, for example, if you think of the first of John le Carré's first novel, A Murder of Quality, which is a detective novel, not a spy novel, I mean, that's set in a boys' boarding school. So in a sense, it is his, and I think that's about 1959. And that's, in a sense, his kind of small environment. So the actual plot device, which encourages you to have a country house, is still there. But as you correctly say, it's almost satirical or very dated. I mean, Michael Innes, J.I.M. Stewart, is still writing country house stories after World War II, but they do have a rather dated quality to them.
So what replaced the country house as a major theme? Inner London or urban squalor?
Well, first of all, you correctly say, or said a minute ago, that television often, for a long time, and I'd say the same with film, took us, as it were, back. So you can have country houses revived, as in the most of these I've only ever seen once many years ago, but I think the Elizabeth Taylor version of The Mirror Cracked from Side to Side, the Agatha Christie story. So there you've got an American film star taking over a British country house. So first of all, you can have films like country houses. I mean, for fairly obvious reasons. A, they're scenic. B, you can rent them as a job lot. C, you can control the surrounding noise. So they work very well. And of course, a lot of the later fascination or just usage of the interwar setting reflects in part film and television versions. So I think that is important. But if you're talking about stories set in the here and now, the story writers of the 1950s, 60s, 70s, you can think of people like Raymond Postgate or Simmons, or I think you've mentioned Josephine Tay, or other people who I'm just reading at the moment some of the novel by a woman called Mary Kelly, and I think it's 1958. It starts, I'm only about five pages in, but it starts with the discovery of a body in a really run-down, seedy London boarding house. So that's very different to a classic 1920s story, you might say, but actually you'll find 1920s stories that include seedy boarding houses. I think one has to be cautious about having a stereotype for an entire period.
You mentioned earlier on the series, the British Library's Crime Classics. Perhaps particularly for listeners who aren't familiar with this collection, what is the style and theme and the selection process that appears for these classics?
Right. Well, somebody I don't know called Martin Edwards, who's prominent in the Detection Club, has obviously persuaded the British Library to publish at a very modest price, I think it's £8.99 is most of them, sort of books that are essentially by novelists we either don't know terribly well, or we don't know at all, or we do know but have been out of print for, these particular ones have been out of print for a long time. And as I said, I mean, you know, I'm reading currently this one by Mary Kelly, and after that I've got another Mary Kelly to read, and I've never heard of her before. That's a reflection of the fact that I'm not a professional reader in this field. But I think it's fair to say that they've had a lot of success in in writers. I mean, E.C. Lorak is another one. She was that's her pseudonym. She was a prominent writer of the 40s and 50s. She wrote novels set in wartime London, but also in rural areas, including Devon and including the Lancashire, North Lancashire. These are very interesting pieces. There, I mean, for example, the accounts of what rural life was like during the war are really fascinating. But they present also a setting in which people are not born into, as it were, patrician households. But they're great. I think they're very successful. And one of the things I like about the series, and I'm trying to read all of them, and they're, I'm glad to say, publishing several a year, so I can't always do so. But one of the things I like is that they are digestible. They give you a sense of something that you don't know about, which is enormously pleasurable. They're to the point in this, which I think is very important. None of these novels are enormous. So one of the things I'm very disappointed with in general with the publishing world is the way in which people go mad and have novels that are far too long. I mean, the recent Anthony Horowitz, ridiculous length, for example. And I think the writers in the past had a much better sense of, and publishers in the past, of producing a work that's going to operate more successfully for the average reader and the amount of time that they have. So I like these. And then on top of that, Edwards produces at least two a year of collections of short stories, which are historic ones, which are ones that have largely sort of nobody's noticed, as it were, or were read at the time and then have been completely forgotten. And, you know, after a number of themes, so I've got on my one of my piles at the side of the bed, one of scientific detection stories. But he's done, you know, stories with sport in, or stories set on trains. These are short stories, or stories set on travel on the continent, several Christmas ones. And I've read all of those, and those have all been very interesting. And of course, the great thing about a short story, if you don't like it, move on to the next one. There's nothing wrong with that at all. You're not there under some sort of punishment or penalty.
Looking at the catalogue for the British Library's Crime Classics, I saw there was one called The Division Bell Mystery by Ellen Wilkinson, who was, of course, Secretary of State for Education in Clement Attlee's government. I mean, two things. One, is it any good? And secondly, how unusual is it for people who've made an alternative career, let's say in public life, like Ellen Wilkinson, to try their hand at writing detective novels, and how successfully do they achieve that?
Right, the Ellen Wilkinson, in my view, it's a good novel, less good as a detected novel, if you see what I mean. I'm not sure that the reveal really worked for me. You know what I mean, the solution. But I think it's a good novel, and it gives you a feel of a certain view of the House of Commons. On your second point, I think it's fair to say that in the past, parliamentarians used to write very widely. I mean, if you think about people like Derby or Gladstone or Churchill, they're only the most famous of writers, and all sorts of people were members of Parliament. I mean, you know, man like Mackinder, who I'm very interested in as the great British geopolitician. He was also for a while a member of Parliament. Just as, you know, for a while we actually had people, I mean, you know, this is going to sound like a cheap jibe, but it's all too true. The same thing was true of vice chancellors. We had distinguished people, men and women, who were people of great scholarship. And I'm afraid to say I don't think most people are up to it now. I mean, you know, you can meet people. I remember I twice had the privilege of meeting P.T. James and talking to her. P.D. James, and you know, I thought, you know, what an able person she was.
I wonder how detective novels, certainly those written in the last 30 years, have changed fundamentally from those written in the Golden Age between the war. The settings have changed, and perhaps the style of writing, would you say? Or in essence, have we had all the plots now, and they're just being reframed in slightly different circumstances?
Well, they're going in all sorts of different directions. I mean, I personally don't like the pathology approach, you know, so the Patricia Cornwell approach. I don't particularly like that, and I don't like I won't read stories that, you know, this is in a sense being a an escapist, but I won't read stories which have cruelty to children. I won't read stories that are to do with sadism. I won't read stories that are to do with sex crimes, because all of those, I think, are, you know, pretty disgusting. And I don't, you know, I'm reading these in part for leisure. I just don't wish to read about those. And I'm well aware that all of those things go on. I'm just not interested. So, but if you're looking at what we've got at the moment, you've got, first of all, a marvellous series of detective novels for different parts of the country. So you have many parts of the country have and are created by writers with enormous skill. And I think those are very, very good, very interesting. I think you have an ability to present most forms of detective. I myself think that the one type that doesn't tend to get enough coverage is the dumb copper as protagonist. In other words, you usually have the dumb copper there in order to provide the foil for either the bright copper or the bright other member of the public, whatever, journalist, whatever. I actually think the dumb copper as protagonist is an interesting idea. And, you know, the dumb copper solves the problem and at the end makes the arrest. And but obviously, you don't know what's going to happen as a proceed to trial. And of course, the point is that if you're bright and have read it, you realise that the copper has got the wrong person. And if you're really bright, you realise who's done it, but you don't know what's going to happen. I think that's a much more interesting way to look at things. But obviously, that might be a level of complexity beyond which many people don't want to go. And then, of course, there are the separate issues, which I think we should talk about, of the detective on television. Because on television or any visual format, there is a completely different set of ways in which the plot proceeds, a completely different set usually of potential culprits in terms of the numbers of potential suspects. There tends to be a fixation with action as opposed to with intellect or thoughtfulness or just establishing things through conversation. Now, there's no inherent need for that. There's no inherent need why a film or a television program cannot actually dwell a bit more on characterization and on dialogue, but they tend on the whole not to do so, though some of the more successful ones do. What I certainly think is, you ask the question, have we seen it all and done it all? Well, to an extent, there is rediscovery of the past. I mean, I recently read a novel, much proclaimed, which in fact the central idea is not too different from an idea of a novel of a few decades ago, which I remember, called The Dice Man. So, you know, and I'm not saying the man deliberately stole the idea. I'm just saying there can be a circularity of practice. But I think what I would argue is there is a freshness. And I think the freshness can be seen in a number of writers. I think, for example, although I think they're too long, but I think the new J.K. Rowling series, and which also I think has been translated very well to the television, I think those are good. I think they work, and I think they'll still be readable in 30, 40, 50 years' time. Some other novels, you pick them up and you think, no, I can't see somebody wanting to read this in 30, 40 years' time, unless they are fascinated about in terms of a historicized sense of period. But I also read ones set in, you know, foreign countries. I've just read one called Dark Town, set in Atlanta in 1948, which is about two of the early African-American policemen in Atlanta and the problems they cope with, and a really rather brilliant plot. And I thought also a very powerful account of the calumny evil of racism, and I thought worked very, very well. Sometimes, you know, you read ones set in foreign countries and you think, great, and sometimes that's also true of the television as well. I've recently watched the French series Fear by the Lake, Killer by the Lake, Vanquished by the Lake. I'm surprised it isn't Falling in the Lake with your dessert, because you haven't done up your shoes properly. But anyway, they're all in their own way good. But they're very different, for example, to things like Spiral, which is a French series set in the Bidonvilles near Paris. So partly it's horses for courses. What setting are you interested in? And you will find generally a good writer author or script writer or writer of fiction, fiction on the page, who has provided that for you?
Well, we started this discussion with discussing you as a historian and whether it was a form of escapism for you to read detective novels. I want to just end by really almost looping back to that question and asking, is there anything meaningful that a historian can learn from the study of detective novels?
Well, yes. I mean, I, in fact, would like, you know, who knows, I might drop dead of a heart attack this evening. I would like to write a book called England in the Age of Poirot, in which I actually look at the Poirot stories from the point of view of a historian. But, I don't know whether publishers would be interested in that, and I'm not sure that people like you going out of genre. One of the reasons I'm bitterly unpopular in the profession is that I tend to do different things. But the specific thing you asked, several things. First of all, my wife, she's now retired. She was a hospital psychiatrist. She would tell new members of her team that she was a psychogeriatrician. So she would tell new members of her team who came from often from abroad to be trained as well as to practice, she would tell them that they should read detective novels set 30 years, 40 years, 50 years before, because they would get an idea of the sort of social background in which many of the patients would be thinking about in terms of the dialogue they'd be used to, that sort of thing, methods of address, that kind of thing. From my point of view, I frequently try and cite detective novels for a simple reason. Good detective novels are trying to take the ordinary and find in it the extraordinary. In other words, they're not like science fiction. Science fiction is a type of detective story. In other words, what is causing these strange spaces to appear in the sky, or what are the bleeps that we're hearing around the corner? But, you know, you are going to get a fantastical account is the answer in science fiction. In detective fiction, I mean, there are many different types of detective fiction, but usually in detective fiction, it is the ordinary life. It is you going home this evening, if you're going home on the tube, and something extraordinary happening that you might not notice, or that you might only notice in recollection, which counts for, the plot. So in other words, you have to set it in the ordinary, the tube rattling around, moving through light and darkness, people in the way both trying to protect their anonymity, but also curious about their neighbours, that very odd sociability of a tube or asociability of a tube, and then something happens.
Well, Professor Black in the library with the detective novel. We'll have to leave it there, but thank you very much for sifting the evidence.
Many thanks indeed.
If you've enjoyed listening to The Critic podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the offer of 3 issues for just £5 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.